Hi, this is Kip Laxon, and I welcome you to a Faith Matters Today podcast. I'm so glad that you have chosen to join me, and I hope you've enjoyed the previous ones. If you've not listened to those yet, I encourage you to do that while we take tackle issues related to biblical studies, theology, religious studies, and some philosophy as well. Today, we want to delve into some biblical studies issues. You know, one of the most colorful characters in the Gospels is John the Baptist. John the Baptist, the forerunner of Jesus, famously in the third chapter of Matthew, he comes preaching. He's odd looking, says he was dressed in camel's hair, ate locusts and wild honey, lived out in the wilderness, proclaiming a message of repentance. He's known, of course, as John the Baptist, or literally John the Baptizer, because he practiced what we today know as Christian baptism, but then it would have been a form of Jewish ritual cleansing, where cleansing themselves in the water as a symbol of their repentance. And John the Baptist, with his preaching, was calling people down to the water's edge of the Jordan River and was encouraging people and baptizing people in this ritual cleansing. Of course, Jesus came one day and John the Baptist saw him. John and Jesus were cousins, as you may or may not know. And when John the Baptist saw Jesus, he pointed him out as the Messiah. There is the Messiah, the one who's come, the promised one who's come. And then, of course, Jesus wanted to be baptized by John. And John resisted that and said, you know, you should be the one baptizing me. But Jesus insisted, and John baptizes him in the water, in the River Jordan. And then Jesus has this spiritual affirmation experience. The heavens open, and the voice speaks, and like a dove settles upon him. And famously said, God says, this is my son whom I'm well pleased. John the Baptist at the center of all of that early work and ministry of Jesus. As I said a moment ago, one of the most colorful characters, I think, in all of the New Testament. And yet, what do we really know about him? Well, I raise the issue of John the Baptist because of this. In July of 2010, on an island known as Zvevi Ivan, or St. John's Island, in the Black Sea, just off the coast of Bulgaria, while excavating old ruins of a monastery and a basilica, a small bone box made of volcanic stone was discovered buried in an older part of the church. Now, let's just stop right there for a moment and talk about a bone box known as an ossuary. In the ancient days, the time of Jesus, and of course predating him, when someone passed away, they took the body, placed them in a tomb rather than burying them in the ground like we do today. The body would then, of course, deteriorate and turn back to dust, ashes to ashes, dust to dust. Once that process had been completed, the bones of that individual had been placed in a box known as a bone box or an ossuary, and then that bone box would be placed in an internal tomb or in a deeper place, or sometimes placed in the ground. Now, I'm not trying to sound morbid, but I'm just explaining what has happened and how that works in those days. So, an archaeological discovery was found in the excavation of an old Orthodox monastery and a basilica. And this bone box shares some things with us about John the Baptist. For instance, inscribed on the ossuary, or the bone box, are the words in Greek, St. John, and the date, June the 24th. So St. John, June the 24th, is inscribed on this box. Now, here's the interesting part as well. June the 24th is known as the feast day of John the Baptist on the church liturgical calendar. And church tradition also maintains that the June the 24th is the feast day because that is also the day in which John the Baptist was born. Now, who knows for sure about that, but regarding his birthday. But what we do know is that the 24th of June has a major significance on the church liturgical calendar and has had that significance from the early New Testament church days. So that's the discovery. Now, here are the facts that we know about that. Just stop and think about that for a moment. Here's this ancient ossuary, a bone box that is found, containing an inscription of St. John, June the 24th. June the 24th, the feast day of St. John the Baptist. But does that box and the bones, do they date back to that time? Well, here's where it gets really interesting. Thomas Higgum, a professor of archaeological science at the University of Oxford, and his team were brought in following the discovery to look for DNA and to test the authenticity of these bones. And they did. Higgum and his team then took the bones to the Oxford Radiocarbon Accelerator Unit, one of the world's top laboratories to do this kind of work. And 2 years later, this is, of course, a long and laborious process. It's not overnight, but very litigious in their work. 2 years later, it produced a result that even Professor Higgum was astounded by. I understand, though I don't have verification, that Higgum was a professed atheist. Whether that's the case or not, or that's just urban legend, either way, Professor Higgum and his team discovered some things that they never anticipated. They discovered that the human bones in this box date right to the middle of the first century AD, or also known as the Common Era, at the time of Jesus. Testing the genetic material by experts at the University of Copenhagen showed that the bones all came from the same man. So this was not a collection, if you will, of bones from various individuals, but these all came from the same person and that he was of Middle Eastern origin. Now, you think about that for a moment. This bone box is discovered inside the bones that date back to the first century, time of Jesus, knows that it to be a Middle Eastern man. The box is inscribed at St. John, June the 24th. So the question arises, could these be the bones of John the Baptist? Now, what we are delving into here is, yes, some speculation, but also some historical finding and some scientific investigation that I've already illustrated. But we also are in the area of holy relics. Now, for those of us in modern America and in the Protestant Christian world, the veneration of relics is not something that is really central to our expression of faith. When I was doing my doctoral ministry work at the University of the South, Episcopal School of Theology at Suwannee, it was said that in the altar table in the chapel of the School of Theology was the thumb or a portion of the thumb of the Apostle of St. Peter. People said that, though, in a almost a tongue-in-cheek sort of way, but it was part of the lore and part of the mythos about that altar table. Now, I was never able to verify that. When I asked about it, and they'd say, go take a look at the table, and you could go and see that there was this small portion of something or another embedded in the table and embedded in glass in the altar table. But whether or not it was the actual thumb of the Apostle Peter, who knows for sure. This illustrates that down through Christian history, various Christians, both in the Roman Catholic and the Eastern Orthodox primarily, and in the Protestant tradition as well, holy relics of the apostles and people that date back to the time of Jesus have said to be held at certain churches, shrines, monasteries, and that people have venerated these relics because it gives us a connection to the ancient world at the time of Jesus. Such is the case with John the Baptist. When this ossuary of bones was found with St. John's inscription on it and the date, and then the scientific discovery and investigation puts it back to the time of Jesus around the first century AD, and that this was a Middle Eastern individual, then people's eyebrows are raised. How did this get there? Who inscribed it? Does it all of that date back to that actual time? One thing that comes to mind as well when we talk about the discovery of what have been come to have been known, quote unquote, the bones of John the Baptist, is something that John P. Meyer at the University of Notre Dame, professor of theology at the University of Notre Dame, specializes in the biblical studies in Christianity and Judaism in antiquity. I've read his works, the famous collection of works called The Marginal Jew, Rethinking the Historical Jesus. He does outstanding work and is a renowned New Testament scholar. He makes a comment, quote, "Not to understand the Baptist," referring to John the Baptist, "is not to understand Jesus." John Meyer makes the point that I think is a crucial one, that if we're really going to understand Jesus, the historical Jesus, in the way we have him in the New Testament gospel accounts, you have to also have an understanding of John the Baptist. And the discovery of these bones and their study that has followed and still under study and scientific investigation even today, raises the issue about who he was and what he was about. So let's talk about what the New Testament tells us about John the Baptist. And I'm referring here to the four Gospels in the New Testament of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. What do they say? What do each of these Gospels have to say about John the Baptist? Well, first, let's take the Gospel of Mark. Whether or not these bones in the box are the bones of John the Baptist, here's what we know about John the Baptist from the Gospel of Mark. The earliest Gospel, Mark, is known and accepted by the majority of biblical scholars as being the earliest written Gospel that we have in the New Testament. The earliest Gospel, Mark, opens with John the Baptist being described as a voice crying out in the wilderness. All the major elements about John the Baptist are there. His prophetic voice, his role as a baptizer, he has a broad appeal. People came out of the cities, primarily the city of Jerusalem, to hear him, even if they were just there to check out this wild and strange motley prophet. Who knows for sure? He also is said in the Gospel of Mark to have to practice an ascetic lifestyle. And in Mark's Gospel, Jesus is baptized by John, and following his baptism in the River Jordan by John the Baptist, Jesus launches his public ministry. Then we turn to the Gospel of Matthew. What does the Gospel of Matthew have to say about John the Baptist? Well, Matthew has a similar depiction as you find in the Gospel of Mark. For instance, John is a prophetic voice. His role as a baptizer, he has a broad appeal, and he has an ascetic lifestyle. In the Gospel of Matthew, Jesus is baptized by John in the River Jordan and launches his public ministry. But here's something different in Matthew than you find in Mark, something additional. After John the Baptist is killed, his followers ask for his body and bury the body, and then they go to tell Jesus what they've done. Matthew reports this part of John the Baptist's experience and his relationship to Jesus, unlike what Mark reports. Then when we come to the Gospel of Luke, we see some similarities between Luke and Mark and Matthew. For instance, as in Mark and in Matthew, in John's Gospel, or rather in Luke's Gospel, John the Baptist has a prophetic voice. He has a role as a baptizer, he has a broad appeal, and he practices an ascetic lifestyle. Jesus is baptized by John in the River Jordan and launches his public ministry. However, Luke gives us details about the birth of John the Baptist that the other Gospels of Matthew and Mark do not give us. There is that part of the Advent story about Zechariah and Elizabeth who give birth to John the Baptist, and that the Virgin Mary, while pregnant with the Christ child, goes to spend some time with her cousin Elizabeth. And Elizabeth is also bearing this child John the Baptist. This information that Luke gives us, you find nowhere else in the gospel accounts about John the Baptist. And then we come to the Gospel of John, not to be confused with John the Baptist. John the Baptist is not credited as an author of the Gospel of John. Rather, the Gospel of John is written by a different individual named John, who was one of the apostles of Christ, according to church tradition. The Gospel of John also reports some things to us that are similar about John the Baptist that you'll find in the Gospel of Mark and Matthew and Luke. For instance, John also has the depiction of John the Baptist as a prophet. He fulfills a role as a baptizer. He has broad appeal with people coming to see him and to hear him, to encounter him, and he also practices an ascetic lifestyle. As is the same in the Gospel of Mark and Matthew and Luke, in John's Gospel, John baptizes Jesus, and following the baptism, Jesus launches his public ministry. But John's focus is an emphasis on the divinity of Christ that is not as pronounced in the other three synoptic Gospels of Mark and Matthew and Luke. John takes from the baptism and the public launch of Jesus' ministry as a way of describing the relationship between God the Father and God the Son, and then builds a stronger case, if you will, for the divinity of Jesus, predicated upon his relationship with John the Baptist through his baptism. So this is what the gospel accounts tell us about John the Baptist. And what is that specifically? Well, first, the land of Israel in the first century world was a political powder keg, and that political powder keg had a short fuse. Judea was relatively small, as we think about the size of Judea at the time of Jesus and John the Baptist, and it also sat at the intersection of history where great armies had clashed and empires would rise and fall. John the Baptist entered into that world of political strife and conflict, in particularly between the Roman occupying forces in the land of Judea and the Jewish establishment. John the Baptist famously calls out King Herod for his adultery and his lavish and worldly lifestyle. John the Baptist, in this political tension. Another thing that these gospel accounts tell us, give us a feel for the time in which John the Baptist lived, was that religious ferment in the land went right along with the political unrest. Let me share this quote with you to illustrate that. It's important to realize that not all Jews were expecting a Messiah, but some were. The kind of Messiah that those Jews were expecting would vary. They would vary in their understanding of what a Messiah would be. Some were expecting simply a human leader that would collect all of the Jews from around the world, or some were expecting a Messiah that would challenge the Roman hegemony in the land of Israel and reestablish a Davidic kingdom with its capital in Jerusalem, going back to the good old days of King David. Other people were expecting a Messiah who would be a great prophet or a great teacher or one who would work miracles, perhaps even bringing about the end of the world as we know it through some kind of judgment. This description in this quotation is from Rabbi Joshua Garraway. He's the associate professor of early Christian history at Hebrew Union College. I quote him because what he's demonstrating is that there was a variety of views about who the Messiah would be. There was also a variety of views about those who would prepare his way, like John the Baptist, known as the one who prepared the way for Jesus. his understanding of what a Messiah would be like. And the people who gathered to hear John the Baptist preach and to cleanse themselves in the river, and Jesus follows in their wake, in their pathway, was in a world of great turmoil, religious turmoil, political turmoil. The expectancy of a Messiah was very different and very unique from person to person of what they thought that Messiah would be. There's another thing that this tells us, and that is that at that time, John the Baptist was more influential than Jesus, at least at first. John the Baptist has the power to pronounce, here's the one, this is Jesus, this is the Messiah, the Son of the living God, the one who comes to take away as the Lamb the sin of the world. John the Baptist had at that moment the influence, the proclamation, and the power. It might seem to us today obvious that Jesus is more important than someone like John the Baptist or some of the other characters in the Gospels. But if we'd have been alive in first century Palestine at the time that John the Baptist was preaching and teaching, then his name and his reputation, the name, the reputation of John the Baptist, we would have known who he was. But chances are, at that point in time, we might not have known who Jesus was. So from John the Baptist's pronouncement about Jesus, we see the rise of then the Jesus movement. And that brings us then to another question. Why was the movement that Jesus started so successful? Apart from the divinely ordained role, why was Jesus' movement ongoing while John the Baptist's movement withered? You know, that's one of the things we see in the gospel accounts about John the Baptist. He's so influential at the beginning. He's baptizing people. The people, the throngs of people are coming out to hear him. He's not afraid to speak truth to power. He then identifies who Jesus is. Following that, he begins to recede. Once he proclaims Jesus Christ as the Lamb of God, the Messiah, the one you've been looking for, and following his baptism of Jesus in the River Jordan, John begins to recede in importance and in power, in privilege, and influence. What was it about the Jesus movement and the John the Baptist movement that was different? Well, some distinctions I think are important. There are four. The first is this, that Jesus is said to have risen from the dead, and John did not. Jeffrey Smith, the professor of early Christianity at the University of Texas in Austin, says that, quote, following John's death, a lot of his followers may have migrated over to the Jesus movement because, unlike Jesus, when John the Baptist died, he stayed dead. We have no stories of resurrection surrounding John the Baptist. But as you well know, the stories of resurrection that surround Jesus carry the movement, Jesus and his movement, onward. So that's one reason why the movement of Jesus moved forward, thriving in its proclamation, even down to the present day, and John the Baptist movement withered. A second reason, aside from the resurrection accounts, is that Jesus and John practiced different types of ministry. Jesus of Nazareth and John the Baptist practiced their ministry in different ways. For instance, Jesus was a miracle worker. That's just one of the things that we have to accept and wrap our mind around, that accompanying him throughout the Gospels, where he went, where he preached, where he taught, were ways in which he touched people in miraculous ways to change, transform their life. John the Baptist did not perform miracles, at least not in any account we have, but rather his performance, if you will, surrounded the issue of baptism. These were two different kinds of ministries. We don't have any record in the New Testament Gospels of Jesus baptizing anyone. We have the record of John the Baptist, known as John the Baptizer, who his whole mission and ministry revolved around this ancient practice of Jewish cleansing in the waters of the river. So their ministry focus were different. That's one reason I think that Jesus' movement thrives and John the Baptist's movement withers. A third reason I think that we must highlight is that Jesus created a community of followers around him. And he had a community for a wider audience to share in. Jesus famously has the 12 apostles. And from that, there were other followers and branches like spokes on a wagon wheel or branches on a tree that move out in all directions from its root. The picture of John the Baptist that we have in the gospel accounts does not depict him doing that. He was a solitary prophet, living alone, it seems, in the wilderness, strangely dressing, strangely eating, coming out from time to time almost as if hiding in a cave and coming out to preach and to speak and to proclaim, to prophesy, and then to challenge the people to repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand, and to be baptized and prepare for the unknown future. Different than the ministry of Jesus and how Jesus created this community around him of both men and women. And everywhere he went, he had these followers that went with him. And then he sent those followers out following his crucifixion and his resurrection to the uttermost parts of the earth, if you will. John the Baptist doesn't do that. His ministry and message was at a particular time and place and done in a particular way that did not have a future impetus to it in the way in which Jesus does. The fourth reason that I think that testified to the difference between the ministry of Jesus and the ministry of John the Baptist is what I just alluded to a moment ago. The followers of Jesus were sent out to evangelize the world. John the Baptist's ministry appears to be local, and it had its center, its epic, if you will, in this one location, in this one place and time. We have no record of John the Baptist raising up followers and sending them out to baptize others. That turns toward Jesus until we come to his great statement on what we call the commission, the great commission, go out into all the world and preach the gospel, baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. And he says, and I will be with you to the ends of the age. Jesus takes on this responsibility of baptism from John the Baptist. He passes it on to his followers, who then are to go out into the world and preach the gospel and baptize others. So it's as if John the Baptist had handed it off to Jesus, whether he did that intentionally or not, or Jesus took that upon himself because of what John the Baptist was preaching and teaching. He wanted to be baptized by John the Baptist. He then takes that as a part of his great commission to his disciples. John the Baptist has had an afterlife of sorts. His relics, pieces of his body, venerated by believers and dispersed throughout world Christendom. So it's not as if John the Baptist has been forgotten. And this whole issue of the bone box discovered and the inscription just reminds us about his presence, his person, who he was. We do not know historically if that really is the bones of John the Baptist. We cannot verify that. But we do know that there are other examples, too, around the world of John the Baptist influence. For instance, near the end of the 4th century, the tomb of John the Baptist was said to have been located in what is today the modern-day West Bank in Israel. There was a monastery that was built to house the supposed head and the remains of John the Baptist in that location. That would seem to run counter to the bone box discovered. But nonetheless, we can't verify that either because that monastery built in the West Bank, supposedly the tomb of John the Baptist, was destroyed somewhere around 361 A.D. Some other examples throughout world Christendom that are numerous churches and shrines and this interesting mosques. Islamic mosque claimed to have various arms and fingers of John the Baptist, including one in the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art in Kansas City, Missouri. Then there are the Mandeans in Iraq. Mandeans are a religious group who actually see John the Baptist and not Jesus as the true Messiah. These ancient religious people embrace John the Baptist as the true Messiah and see Jesus as the forerunner. So in their telling of the story, the roles are flipped than for what we see in the gospel accounts, where John the Baptist is the forerunner, the preparer for the way, and Jesus is, of course, then the Messiah. Some other examples. A church in Rome claims to have the head of John the Baptist. Islamic tradition holds that John the Baptist's head is actually in a mosque in Damascus and not in the church in Rome. Eastern Orthodox Christianity views John the Baptist as the last of the Old Testament prophets. They also list him as a Christian saint. And so he is one of the figures that kind of stands between the closing of the Old Testament era with the prophets of Isaiah and Jeremiah and the beginning of the New Testament era. So they see him as an individual who brings together both of those eras. What this says to us is that John the Baptist, in fulfilling his role, whether those bones in the box are really his or whether these other relics that I mentioned have any real significance or any connection whatsoever to the actual historical John the Baptist who walked the earth just at the time of Jesus and announced that his very cousin, Jesus of Nazareth, was the Messiah. Whether all of that is true or not and point to him or are a part of him or were a part of him when he was living on this earth, John the Baptist challenges each of us in some unique ways. One that I will mention at this moment, and that is that John the Baptist was willing to recede so that Jesus might increase. John the Baptist, often depicted in ancient artwork and ancient frescoes, is pointing toward the Christ. John the Baptist reminds us of our responsibility to always be those pointing toward the Christ. His holy relics, true or not, legitimate or not, are reminders that each of us bear a responsibility to point toward Christ. Now, the Gospels tell us that John the Baptist struggled with the emergence of Jesus, even though he had been the one to say, "This Jesus, he is the Messiah." And he had been the one to baptize him in the River Jordan. Later, after John the Baptist was arrested and put in prison, he would send some people to Jesus to say, "Are you really the Messiah?" I've often wondered what went on in the mind of John the Baptist. Here he is in a very desperate situation. People do desperate things when their freedom has been taken away. He's in this prison cell. He's wondering, "Did I do the right thing? Was this the right choice?" Or perhaps he wanted simple reassurance, for he needed to know that if all that he had been through and now found himself in prison, if Jesus was the Messiah, just one more assurance, and then he would be at peace with it. Ultimately, the story goes that John the Baptist was beheaded at the request of a young girl named Salome, who had danced before the king. And in a bit of political trickery, when the king was taken by her beauty, said, "I'll give you anything." And she said, "I want the head of John the Baptist." And of course, it was delivered. The powerful image of John the Baptist standing on the edge of the river, pointing out Jesus, when he had at that moment all the crowds, all the followers, they were coming to hear and see him. But in that moment, he knew the time was right to say, "There is the Messiah." And from that emerges the public ministry of Jesus of Nazareth. Our responsibility to point to Jesus always has a price to it. We are, of course, asked to give up, to sacrifice certain things, pleasures and amusements sometimes, or a direction that we want to go. Sometimes it's difficult when we have to step aside and let Christ step in the center of the stage. But John the Baptist had his moment in the sun, as we like to say. He was at the center of the spotlight. But there came a time for him to say, there he is. He is the Messiah. He's the one we've been looking for. All of us stand, metaphorically speaking, in the shoes of John the Baptist. For each of us have to make that decision on our own. Will we step aside so that Christ can have the center of attention in our life? I heard it said many years ago as a boy. I don't even remember the preacher, but I remember what the preacher said. It is still with me today in such clarity as if it had been said just a moment ago. In your life and in mine, there is a throne and a cross. And either Christ is still on the cross and you are on the throne, or you are on the cross and Christ is on the throne. John the Baptist is a reminder that each of us have to be willing to place ourselves, our desires, our dreams, our plans. We have to be willing to put those on the cross and put Christ on the throne. We step aside that Christ might take center stage. I want to encourage you to continue to join me for these podcasts. And if you live in the Johnson City, Tennessee area, I am the senior pastor at Muncie Memorial United Methodist Church, just downtown Johnson City. I'd love to see you and meet you and have you be a part of our wonderful community of faith. We have 3 Sunday morning worship services, 2 in the sanctuary at 8:45 and 11, traditional worship services each, and a contemporary worship service at 11 a.m. in the gym in our Christian Life Center. I primarily preach in the sanctuary services twice on Sunday at 8:45 and 11, and our associate minister, Pastor Beth Sullivan, preaches primarily in the Journey service. Once every 6 weeks or so, we do switch or transition, and she'll share in the sanctuary preaching, and I'll preach in the Journey. All of our people and all of our services will welcome you and include you in the Spirit of Christ in this place. So check out our website, muncie.org. Sign up, participate, get involved. And if you don't live in the Johnson City area, you can join us by live stream worship. Just simply go to muncie.org and you'll see the prompts there in the portals for live worship. Until we're together again, I pray God's richest blessings upon you. And I pray that at that place and point in your life where you're willing, step aside and let Jesus Christ take center stage. And you'll never regret that decision. Christ receives the glory. Until we're together again, may God richly bless you.